In Memoriam. Big survey show. You're tempting fate?
Well, the first reason is, yes, I think artists have a difficult relationship with their past work. You're always, you know, thinking about the next work, not necessarily too keen to look back, and I certainly looked back with a degree of trepidation. So that, on the one hand, it's a bit of a funny nod towards that idea, following on from Ed Richet's work, I Don't Want No Retrospective, which in fact became the title of his retrospective. But also, I think it fitted quite nicely into when I started looking closely at, I guess, the history of Heidi and the ghosts that surround this place and how those ghosts are kept alive and not buried properly. But certainly there's a lot of, there's the kind of imprimatur of death surrounding this joint as well. So I think there was a bit of a, on the one hand, a kind of funny turn in it, but quite a serious one as well about looking back, but also reflecting on the particular context that this was happening in.
Well, you're 45 years old. In artistic terms, you're in the middle. You're not emerging, you're established, but artistically you probably have another, well, hopefully, you know, up to 40 years, longer perhaps. So it's very much a mid-career retrospective. How does that feel?
It does seem kind of particularly early to look back. You know, the mid-career is like, well, I'm in the middle.
But you're really young too at the same time. 45 is not an old age for an artist.
Yeah, and I feel that. And I think I purposefully made this show part a reflection on 20 years and choosing certain works that relate to each other, but coupled together with some site-specific work and some new work. So it's part survey show, part new projects. And I think I did a project at the MCA years ago, which was a little bit like this kind of mid-career survey thing, but it was completely a project show as well. So as long as it's just not always past work, I think that happens when you die because you can't do any more.
No, it's the end of your career when you're dead. You were very successful quite young. Has there been any drawbacks in that early success, do you think?
I don't think I was very successful quite young. I think that's not right. I mean, I came from art school in 1989 and I didn't have any success in terms of, well, certainly had critical success probably mid-90s. But, you know, when I came out of art school, we showed an artist-run spaces and I was showing people that, you know, couldn't get shows anywhere else. And so it was the first wave of, or the kind of next wave in the 90s of artists, or the beginning of the artist run space through Store 5 and that kind of period. And I showed there, that was my kind of context. There were a lot of artists that came out of art school straight into the commercial sphere and were very successful and have been very successful. And I think that question is probably a bit more appropriate to them. I think that...
You have a very impressive resume. I mean, there's 14 whole pages of it.
Oh, well, you know, you have a show on the side of a road and you put it on your CV, I suppose. But you know, I have done a lot, I suppose. But I'm just saying, in terms of that success, I feel that's come later, you know, in the scheme of things, you know.
Is there things that you would have done differently, looking back from this vantage point?
Well, yes, probably everything. But I think at some point you have to just stare. I mean, that's the trial or the terror of the mid-career show, when you have to look back and you kind of stare into what you've done. And, you know, I certainly was pretty neurotic about it to begin with. But I suppose when you stare back, you kind of commit to what you've done. You know, if you don't own what you've done, I think you're in sort of trouble. But I think there's certainly lots I want to do. And certainly, I think I'm a child of my time. I think I can see that. You know, I think it's still talking to me in a way, which is quite nice, about what the possibilities are through the stuff I haven't done. I mean, artists are probably generally pretty restless, so there's lots of things I want to do and lots of things, you know, I wish I could have done, or I don't sit around thinking about it too much, to be honest, but I do think there's always books to have been written and, you know, films to have been made and all that kind of thing, and other works to have been done, but you know, I'm not really thinking about that.
When you look at it, do you think, oh, I can see where I've come from, I can see... And it is an interesting thing to have a look at that 20-year journey. Mm. Does it make you feel that you know more clearly where you're going in the future? Does it help you to see into the future?
In every show, there's always a work, I think, that announces the next work. You know, at certain times in my career, I did think, oh, well, look, you know, I really want to do some outside work, and that... You know, these speculations on the kind of urban world that I brought into the gallery did become this kind of virtual universe, and I started thinking about it'd be nice to get out into the world and put these things out there. So, and I do really remember that sort of moment, and I suppose I'd done enough that perhaps people would be inclined to give me the opportunity to do some outside projects. And I am very much the next work person, I think, in the sense that, you know, I'll certainly address a context that I'm given, if I'm given one, and all the kind of multiplicity of sites around, say, a place like Heidi generates ideas for work. And I am that sort of artist. I like to have the context to work off, which is probably why I can say I'm as good as the next work kind of thing. So, you know, it's projecting way into the future. That's a difficult thing to do.
A lot of your practice is about lives led in houses that are no longer there, ghosts in kind of ghost houses. Valhalla was a ghost house built in response to a house that your father built. The gas and fuel building that was demolished to make way for Federation Square, the hotel on the East Lank Freeway, where the solitary cat now lives. Are you haunted by ghosts?
Is there still a cat in the east, is there? I heard that. I mean, the survey show is so difficult because, you know, now I'm sitting down here and I have to think about my past and think about myself in kind of broader terms historically. And I've always only... I mean, when you've interviewed me in the past, we're really just talking about one work. But am I haunted by ghosts? Yeah, probably. I mean, I think everyone is in some way. I think the world's kind of haunted by ghosts. I'm interested in negotiating the recent past, and I'm interested in bringing kind of history into a kind of narrative with works. And then colliding that with my own history. So, you know, if there aren't ghosts that I'm personally haunted by, I think I'm haunted by, you know, the world's ghosts as much as anybody else. The ghost is something that really hangs around because it's not buried properly. So if that's a kind of definition of a ghost, so someone like Heidi is kind of haunted by that, it's surrounded by a kind of almost a voyeuristic set of narratives about these lives led. What interested me about that was there were kind of these two things that were going on in my head. On the one hand, there was this contest of ideas around, you know, the 30s and 40s and 50s and those and what those artists were producing and what was at stake. You know, grand ideas, I think. And then this kind of personal...
Gossipy kind of
story. And the collision of those two things is kind of perfect for me because I think it's the personal and the public colliding. So, you know, in a sense, because of the gossipy stuff, you can't really get to the contest of ideas a lot of the time. And because Heidi has to keep going, and because this whole world that they constructed is the kind of myth around which people come to visit the place, and it becomes a sort of theme park, if you like, of, you know, art history or architectural history or whatever...
But that would fit in with your practice. I mean, the theme part of architectural history is kind of what you're talking about in a way.
Yeah, I am interested in how those kind of histories become spectacle. And I am interested in other forms of spectacle using the structure or the visual register of the theme park. But talking about, you know, say for Valhalla, it was the kind of anti-spectacle, but it was like a theme park ride where nothing happened. And similarly here, I've turned that building into a kind of ghost train. I merged it with the one in Luna Park because... Well, there are cues because, you know, so many of those artists did stuff with Luna Park and...
those artists being
Joy Hester.
Albert Tucker and Joy Hester.
Albert Tucker, Sidney Nolan and Joy Hester. I guess in the end I was particularly interested in the relationship between John and Sunday Reid, Joy Hester and Sidney Nolan.
As is everybody.
Yeah, but I mean, there are all these other figures, but when you kind of excavate it, it's kind of like they're the four that are left. Mm.
There is a kind of possibility that it becomes deeply sentimental and it takes away from the kind of more serious purpose of a place like Heidi to make it about those people's lives rather than about their ideas.
Yeah, I think that's what I was trying to get to, that that when I was kind of measuring up and researching this kind of history, you know, immediately the kind of gossipy one is compelling. Well, Barrett Reed, you know, wrote this letters of John Reed, or edited these letters of John Reed. And that's about the contest of ideas, and even says in the introduction, you know, say the Janine Burke focuses on the gossipy and he's focusing on the kind of contest of ideas. And, you know, I felt like I wanted to represent both those things in some way. I haven't really immersed it in the kind of gossipy, I don't think. Yeah. I mean, I've made the fireplace.
Maybe you should describe it first.
Well, I'll describe that room, actually, if you'd like, because it starts at one end with International Style, which is a 1 to 10 scale model of the Farnsworth House, and then there's a model of Villa Savoy called Open House with these two films projecting out of it. And then a little model of Le Corbusier's Cabanon, which is the cabin where he died.
With a heartbeat inside.
Yeah, he died the day I was born. So it was just kind of this, you know, story around that. So it's got a heartbeat, but if you look in the window, there's a little brain, floating brain in there too. So those models are at a kind of particular scale, you know, doll's house kind of scale. And then when you go through the kind of walls into the next room, you've got Gas and Fuel at 1 to 34 scale, which is the number of years it was alive for, which were the Gas and Fuel buildings that used to be where Fed Square is.
With a little voice down in the basement crying out, help me, help me.
Help me, please help me, which is my voice, but taken, you know, mimicking the voice from the 1958 film of The Fly. And then there's in the end room, there's a 1-to-1 scale model, it's the works called 1-to-1, of the fireplace that's in Heidi 2, which is the Maglash and Everest house. So what you've got in that room is this stretch of scales from a kind of diminutive through to full scale, which is like the closer, and I've said this before, you're kind of squeezing things down a portal, the closer you get to the kind of site of origin, the bigger it gets, you know. And so 1-to-1, yes, it's I've built it at 1-to-1. It's ripped out of its context, if you like.
This is the fireplace you're talking about.
The fireplace, I should say. And so I haven't done the pit with a very evocative carpet and all that. I've just taken the fireplace out, and I think when you remove it and decontextualize it and put it in a room on its own, it kind of looks like a crematorium. It kind of, you know,
the heart of a family, two people gather around a fire.
Yeah, but it's a kind of mobile hearth. It can be wheeled in anywhere, you know. But it is the hearth of the house, and you know, it's the room that was occupied the most in that house. And I have put there's a recording, the kind of last recording. I think the only recording is Sunday Reed on tape, and John Reed, and they're just. It's in 1981, they're old, and he's being interviewed by Richard Hazer, and Richard Hazer's been edited out, and it's just sounds like Sunday Reed and John Reed talking about pretty banal memories.
Yes, I think I had an income of £350 a year, and I had to pay my way entirely with that.
How did you afford all of this?
Well, you just did, you know, went on very cheap holidays. I had a motorbike, that was my great joy. A four-valve Triumph, the first four-valve bike produced, I think. And I used to go all over the place. And
with a dog?
With a dog, yes, I had a dog. It was a mongrel, it was a cross between a Yorkshire Terrier and goodness knows what else.
How'd you keep the dog on the motorbike?
Used to ride in the sidecar. I bought a sidecar for him.
Yeah,
we went all over the place. We went up Scotland and took him up there all over.
And then I've put this fairly schmaltzy Mozart under it and pushed the sound a bit further up the fireplace to cast them as ghosts, if you like. But it's quite banal, and it's quite old person's home kind of thing. And
But it is nonetheless their authentic voices coming from a replica of their fireplace in this place. So it is really spooky. They are like, you know, they're coming back from the dead to talk down the chimney.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not, their conversation isn't gossipy And I guess that's the point I got to, that through all that stuff of being interested in the gossipy but then interested in the contest of ideas and which should I privilege, and I'd done all this research to get to this fairly basic outcome, if you like. And I mucked around in the edit with those voices, and I was going to get actors to do it, and I kind of went through all this stuff. But when I heard the tape just on its own, it just felt right that in a way it was just two people's lives in the end. And that, yeah, sure, they were experimental lives and there was all this kind of stuff around it, all this kind of spectacle around it. But when you listen to it, all that spectacle kind of fell away. And I like that. So I kind of made it sentimental, but it is kind of eerie. But I think in some ways it's sort of tender too.
Oh, I wasn't a good skier, but I got around and I enjoyed it tremendously.
You fell in love with
her? The skiing or with the girls?
Girls.
No, I fell in love more or less, I suppose, with one girl.
But then, you know, the little voice intoning, "Help me, please help me" in Gas and Fuel, I mean, could be read as Sweeney Reed. That work changes context. Every time it changes context, it was shown in Berlin. So, of course, in Berlin, they had no idea about the local context of this building, which I made when Fed Square opened. So that was the context I was working in historically.
Because we have to say that the Gas and Fuel Corporation had that building on the corner where Fed Square is now, and it's gone. And without much, people didn't particularly grieve its going because it was seen as a rather ugly icon.
Yeah, it was a much maligned, probably rightfully so. Whether I liked it or not wasn't the point. It was just this idea, I guess, that when it was built, it was greeted with much fanfare, but when it died and was knocked down,
it was also greeted with fanfare, but they were cheering.
Happy it was gone, and even the architect was like, well, I'm done with it too. Perhaps they're right. Perhaps there should be a kind of another solution here. But Fed Square was greeted with the same, you know, euphoria, I suppose.
But the funny thing about the Gas and Fuel Corporation is that the son of the architect bought that piece and it's now on the site where it was, isn't it, in Fed Square, usually?
Yeah, it's a great story. Corbett Nyadji Lyon gifted it to the NGV, and then it appeared in the kind of first show at Fed Square, and it is usually set up in a kind of atrium space between two galleries, and they keep the sound down because Fed Square, the acoustics are so amazing, bad, whatever you want to say, that the sound just bounces all around the place, and some elderly people get quite upset trying to look for a little child lost. So, you know, the lost child thing is kind of recreated. And some of the guards did go around looking for this child that was trapped somewhere. So it became quite a disturbing presence for them. And so they kept turning it down all the time. And I would go in periodically when it was on display and check that. Because without the sound, it becomes some commemorative model, you know.
It loses all its, all its irony, or its, well, in fact, all its human scale.
Yeah, well, yeah, and it loses its psychological dimension. You know, the soundtracks are these loops that, you know, are kind of figures, really. They're the kind of figures in the landscape.
Well, they're the animation,
yeah,
in a way.
Yeah, the animation, yeah. So, you know, so I would go in and I'd turn it up. And then here, with the kind of voice going, you know, immediately people started connecting it to Sweeney Reed. And, of course, Sweeney Reed, straight away, Sweeney Reed becomes the kind of tragic story. And I think remains this kind of, you know, tragic story, an abandoned child or what have you. And is the kind of, is probably the real ghost that haunts Heidi, I think.
Because we have to remember, Sweeney was Albert and Joy's son, who was then adopted by Sunday and John, who didn't have their own children. And he killed himself when he was quite young. That's the story, isn't it?
Yeah, that is the story. And in fact, I don't even know if it was Albert Tucker's son. In fact, the feeling now is that, in fact, he was the son of an affair that Joy Hester was having with a drummer, a jazz drummer. So, you know, anyway, there are so many stories. And in the end, it was kind of, every time I came out here, someone told me a different story and everyone had a different take on it. And, you know, and of course, there's all these attempts to make the film of Heidi. A couple of people have tried, and there's apparently some television series in the making now. So the kind of myth continues. And I guess coming back to that idea of them just being it was just a couple of lives that had a fair degree of tragedy around it. but they tried a lot of things in a kind of experimental period, you know, culturally. And all those artists at Murrumbeena, you know, the Boyds and, you know, Montsalvat and Adrian Lawler and all this stuff that was kind of happening out here, and the history of that place, you know, they were kind of connecting into that kind of history. And there's nothing wrong with experimental lives. I think it's great, you know. So that in the end, that's kind of what I found. I found the kind of hope of or this kind of progressive nature that they were pursuing, that of course always will, like any utopian drive, will always end up failing in some way, and there'll always be there will always be casualties.
Do you think they're unquiet ghosts?
Well, I think with things that aren't buried properly, I mean, how do you bury something properly? I suppose you give it its bury, you give something the proper burial rites, but you also recognise everything about it, you know, or confront everything about it. So if there's things that you haven't confronted, those ghosts will remain. And to me, say some of the big ideas that I've always been interested in, like modernism is a big idea, and modernism has many faces. And, you know, here was a kind of a sort of crucible of modernity, and it's as much about the return of modernity and its constant return, you know, the return of those ideas.
And the utopia that often fails.
Yeah, the utopia that fails, but I think that I see more really the grand ideas of modernity. So if we're in a period of great turmoil in the world now, the pressing in of climate change and how that affects the way we approach the built environment, everything in our lives, that's just one example. So ecologically, economically, politically, so everything is being looked at again, or needs to be kind of looked at again. They're the ideas that were being contested by the Reeds in those early days. So I'm quite interested in the return of those things. So it's not eatable in the sense that I'm always trying to kill it. I'm just interested in the fact that it returns, and that the ghosts keep chattering because the ideas are never resolved, or things are never resolved.
So it's a happy chat then. They're not unhappy ghosts that you hear. They're ghosts that are actually still to this day contributing to the conversation.
I think so. I mean, it's not actually all that dour as well. I mean, it's not like that. That's kind of one face of my work, I guess. But in things like the Farnsworth House, where you get that looping soundtrack of a party that goes awry and a woman screams, "Don't you dare touch me," and five gunshots go off, and there's, you know, Lilliputian screams, and then you know, it stops and it all starts again. But there was as much in that about, here's this, you know, iconic form immured in its history, you know, indeed it has become a kind of art object, like a lot of kind of architecture. And so at the time I just wanted to sort of corrupt that interior, you know, when I made that in 1999, it was quite simple, that kind of drive, taking a suburban drama that happens out there, you know, on the fringes, and stuffing it inside this kind of pure form. And at that stage, when I made it, post-modernity had finished, in a sense, certainly in design and architecture, and modernity had returned. So you saw this kind of shifting stylistically, and I was interested in that stylistic shift, you know, whether that contained ideas or whether it was kind of more inclusive. So that work is about putting two things together that shouldn't necessarily be together. But the kind of soundtrack is very Hollywood, it's very LA, it's very David Lynch or something, you know, and it's sort of funny too. And
I think it's based on a real-life incident too. It's based on the drama that was present in the real world between the architect and the owner of the Farnsworth House.
Well, she didn't shoot Mies van der Rohe to start with, but I mean,
She didn't shoot him. No, you, I think I've speculated beyond the kind of reality, but there is nonetheless a kind of element of real world politics behind it.
Yes, I mean, certainly it's a very famous story that Mies van der Rohe and Edith Farnsworth, he designed this glass house for her, and it was a weekender, and they were involved in a relationship that broke down subsequently. And then she derided the house very publicly in magazines like American Home Beautiful, and he remained stoically silent, like the kind of good modernist, I suppose. And she talked about how the house was impossible to live in, you know, there was no privacy and all that kind of stuff. It was the first glass house, you know, and it did fail in that sense. So yeah, there was a kind of, but it was also the rise of television. I was kind of thinking about that. You know, there were all sorts of other sort of popular culture things that I was tipping into that box, if you like. Not just that story. I mean, that story was sort of, you know, again, a kind of gossipy story, there was another contest of ideas about that house and about, you know, Mies coming to America and the evolution of glass and steel architecture, and this kind of was a private version of what became the great public glass and steel architecture that he became famous for, you know, during a prosperous time in America post-war, you know, America that it was kind of flaunting its wealth, and Mies was seen as a very progressive modernist in that sense, you know, a kind of he was seen, I mean, if modernity can be, you know, sometimes divided into a number of spheres which are quite interesting, and there's the one which is the kind of accepting modernity that does believe in kind of progress and does believe in, you know, the architecture somehow being an ad for the kind of prosperity. And Mies was very much a kind of institutional and sort of favoured architect of that time. Modernism could also be described, you know, through various phases as a kind of critical modernity, and there's a sort of negative modernity, and, you know, situationism and all that sort of stuff is on one end of it. And Le Corbusier, in fact, at the end of his life, was a kind of negative modernist, and at the beginning he was, you know, seen as the great champion of the international style, but he turned his whole thinking around and became closer to sort of a sort of earth artist. If you look at the later buildings, like I have a Ronchamp and things, they're for kind of earthy, organic things that belong to the soil. And he was very worried about what the international style had ushered in socially. So it's a kind of complex terrain, and
because what it did usher in was, well, the Soviet housing projects and as we know them, those kind of enormous failures of social housing experiments that are seen as modernism's, well, I don't know, tragedy.
And he was very aware of all that. And the little cabin on is the only house he ever made, for designed for himself, and it's actually a kit home, and it looks like a kind of cabin in the woods. You know, and the interior.
You made a model of this one, in this show.
I made a model of that one, and had this kind of beautiful interior. So, in a sense, and that's at the end of his life. So, in a sense, you got these two versions of him too, and then Gas and Fuel is, you know, is international style, a kind of weird form of international style that came to Australia. So, it's kind of these ideas transported, and indeed, the one to one, this Glashan Everest house is closer to kind of late Le Corbusier or something. It's like immediately a ruin in the landscape. It's how they wanted to see it. It's kind of earthbound. It's sort of has this kind of
organic kind of feel to it. Yeah,
organic materiality. And I think everyone's always associated the fireplace as kind of somehow the centre of that idea.
Yeah, it is a ruin in the landscape, and ruins are very much part of your kind of meditation too. And, in fact, for the rest of the show, there is a sense of the ruinous urban landscape, the drive-in theatre screens that disintegrate, the awnings that have the paint come off, and the, you know, the way that entropy seems to be the kind of overriding principle that governs all architecture.
I mean, there are clearly two experiences in the show. There's that one we just described, the model one, and then when you pass into the next room, it's a less specific world in many senses. So that they're very specific buildings with specific stories, you know, around these specific ideas. But then you're confronted straight away with this up this corridor. I set up these walls so that you kind of got this perspective through this shop that looks like it's been ripped out of its context, and the screens are the same. They're from, you know, no particular place. It was kind of based on a couple of sort of drive-ins, and its evolution. It had a sort of specific evolution for a project that I just turned them into these objects that are simultaneously painting, their sculpture, they're about cinema, they're about light and all these things at once. So they're a bit like drawings for me. I kind of keep doing them because they contain all this stuff. And then there's the little homeless shelter, which again is just made for my body, and then there's the room of drawings and prints, and there are specific places in there, and you know, that they're kind of like the ideas for the larger 3D works.
Let's talk about Monument Number 28, Vortex. And this is one of the site-specific works that you've made for this show. When you come in through the main gallery doors, you can see it as you're entering into the exhibition, because it's at the end of the corridor, and as it looks out onto a window which looks out over the grounds of Heidi. But before you get to the window, there's this extraordinary shape that you've made. Can you talk about how you made that and what it is?
The vortex. The vortex is all polystyrene that's been carved or machined. The vortex, made a number of pieces that kind of slot together. And that form is, it's a scan of interior of a rock, actually. And there are a number of works of mine where I've used kind of organic matter as a kind of subject. Babylonia at Acre, and this works in New Zealand, and there's this grotto I made in the Netherlands. It's a permanent pavilion, actually, in a garden in the Netherlands, which is a grotto inside a black glass box, and you go down. It's like a kind of tomb, if you like, but it's also a bar and a kind of toilet and a kind of music venue in this Baroque garden in the Netherlands. So that's a kind of trajectory, and I've kind of worked around this idea of the organic matter enclosed in a form like that, or a shot. I've done a number of shot works over the years. And vortex is kind of this idea of sort of tunnel, really.
It feels like a tunnel. It feels like you've dug into an earth. A great big piece of earth has been kind of gouged through to get to the outside where the window is. But it's like it reminds me of it's a kind of place that you want to go to but you can't get through to because there's a glass door that encases it with a brick surround. So it's like it's a temptation to want to go through it, but of course you're frustrated by the fact that you can't open the door and it actually goes nowhere. But it has this marvellous illusion of you're being drawn into the myth of Heidi, into the garden of Heidi, out into Sunday's world, out through her, I don't know, through her porthole.
I think this is one of the things that is disturbing about survey shows, that when you do open your eyes and look back, you find that perhaps you've only had a couple of ideas and you've just repeated them ad infinitum, and you just hope to hell that those ideas are okay, or even that one idea. And I think that's true of a lot of artists. And when I think about vortex, you know, there is a sense of it being, there's a box, and there's this tunnel, which suggests a kind of liberation, you know, this... but then you're...
Or a journey.
Yeah. And, I called it vortex, even though it doesn't, I guess, typically describe the physical properties of a vortex or the image of a vortex, but it is. It's a kind of tunnel, and it is a journey. It's like a wormhole. But then there's a glass screen in front of it, and you can't get through it, so can't get to it. And in all my work, there is this sense that there's something inside that you can't get to, and it's a sense of frustration and
tantalization too.
Yeah, I guess so. That you want to get there, but you can't. And even very early on in my practice, there was this. You know, I was playing around with images when I was kind of removing things. You know, and so it's always stripping, say, using sound and the image, but you take out the image and it's just the sound left. And what happens in that kind of removal? Is it frustrating? Does it open up things, though? Does it open up your imagination, or does it open up possibilities by removing something and not telling the whole story, or not filling in the whole picture? So it is interesting with vortex. You know, I didn't think too much about it, you know, and it's one of those works, and all work is like that you think about it after you've made it. You know, you don't want to think too programmatically while you're doing it. I mean, you can talk about Farnsworth House, you know, that I rather programmatically sat down and went, I want to do the Farnsworth House because it's the glass box and I want to put this soundtrack in it but it didn't work like that at all. I wanted to find the most beautiful box and I wanted to put a corrupt sort of party scene in it. I mean, it really started there, and I think it's important to remember that the kernel of these things have a very general, you know, inception, and the specificity and the way you think about it evolves later.
So now you've staged your own funeral show. Are we going to have the Callum Morton theme park?
Well, I mean, have I talked to you about this before? It is a joke amongst friends of mine that I do want to open Callum's World. But I don't know in this climate whether anyone would be willing to give me money to get Callum's World off the ground. But I do think that somewhere like Heidi, if they gave me the garden, I could just sort of carve off a bit of that land and open Callum's World.
He's looking at it now.
I'm looking at it right now. But there are various works like Valhalla and other things that sort of sitting, you know, fallow on a... Fallow, is that a word? Fallow? No. Sitting on a block of land in two 40-foot containers, wanting a home, and the idea that they're kind of these impossible works, you know, they're made for a particular context that was made for Venice, and then it, you know, it's come out, you know, but it really had a specific place that it was meant to be made for, and it's very hard to imagine relocating it. And I'd have to really, you know, quite seriously construct my own world, a bit like Ian Hamilton Finlay, who's in that show, you know, in the show at Heidi 2, the Concrete Poetry Show, you know, he did Little Sparta. You know, because he was so agoraphobic, you know, that he made his own world. And I've always loved that idea, actually. But, yeah, I suppose mine would be the one you drive past on the way up to Queensland. Callum's World is next to kind of, you know, Australia Zoo and all that, you know. Something like that. But, yes. So if any takers out there who want to give me some money to start Callum's World, you know, taking donations now.